Hi, and welcome to the Cloud Computing Show, episode number 31. It's roundtable day. Very happy to have James Waters, the Senior Manager of vCloud Solutions at VMware here. Hi, James.
What's up, Gary?
Doing well, thanks. Brian Bukowski is here. He's the CEO of CitrusLeaf. Hi, Brian.
Gary.
And Adrian Cole, the founder of JClouds and also a happy employee of OpsCode, is here.
Yay.
Adrian Cole. I'm Gary Ornstein, host of the Cloud Computing Show, and we will jump right into the industry news. Just before we sat down to record this episode, we heard some rumors. They started on GigaOm that VMware might acquire EngineYard, which is pretty big news in the cloud computing arena. So, Brian, give us your thoughts on that immediate reaction there.
Well, it doesn't seem like a particularly bad idea for VMware, but they previously were entirely in the space of software. So moving out into a service play where you have to answer the phones and attacking more of the market of web developers and web services seems like a bit of a stretch for them. I'm interested to see if it really turns out.
I think they're being aggressive in many, many fronts about getting people, you know, into cloud computing, whether that's more of the software as a service with the collaboration stuff like Zimbra, or more of reaching developers early on with a platform like SpringSource, or in this case, you know, attracting another group of folks who want to get to the cloud, in the case of EngineYard, typically very specific around, you know, Ruby implementations. So it's a broad strategy, but I think it's much more exciting to have them reaching into these, what I think to be fairly distinct groups, which all culminate in, you know, how do we move apps into a virtualized and or cloud environment.
I could also see them taking the EngineYard IP and technology and folding it into vCloud so that instead of just having vCloud be, hey, it's how you turn servers on and off, but being an all-encompassing development environment, something that more closely parallels Azure than simply the infrastructure as a service play that it is more closely aligned with today. So they could back out of some of EngineYard's current markets and simply take the technology and repurpose. I could see that as being a reasonable play.
That actually makes a lot of sense. I mean, if you look at the recent like Google App Engine type VMForce integration, it is also another play in that same angle, both of which are more hosted type, you know, offerings, at least what we're hearing about now. So, you know, you have to ask a question if we're looking at this about, you know, EngineYard, what they're doing today versus EngineYard, what they would be doing under VMware. And would it be the same thing they're doing or would it be a different approach? And that's what I'm really curious about. I mean, if you look at the long-term product strategy, how would that impact the way EngineYard operates? Or would they just let them be and just, you know, be super cool but also inside the VMware umbrella?
Yeah. I mean, I think when you look at the larger mission, I think, of a company like EngineYard, which is, you know, helping people get scalable apps up and into the cloud, that's really what, you know, is going to benefit VMware, particularly if they're starting to, you know, build a larger ecosystem where they're enabling service providers to do things and so forth.
Now, the interesting thing, again, about this, though, is that if it were about, you know, spreading the adoption of vCloud, considering EngineYard were already moving to like Terramark's, you know, enterprise cloud, which I understand to be VMware based, it actually kind of like, okay, so they're already sold on that, right? So it would have to be something else. It can't just be about vCloud, and so that's I think why it's so interesting. And you know, maybe just from a gossip perspective, we don't have a lot of information from what the posting said.
Yeah, we have no information. We don't even know if it's true.
I think we should.
But it is
this.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So another item wasn't so. Didn't come in the last second, but the last couple of weeks was, as you were mentioning, Salesforce and their partnerships with VMware and Google. I think Salesforce is really reaching out to anybody who's not an enemy as a friend and making sure that folks who are associated with cloud computing, perhaps more on the platform side or more on the infrastructure side, whereas they are more on the software as a service side, right? It's how do I get more of those folks into my tent?
They're so clearly, you know, what they're already doing. Like at Glue, I heard the, you know, evangelist from Salesforce speak, and the thing that was very clear to me was that they actually have no interest, really, in the mechanics of, you know, infrastructure as a service or anything else like that. It's truly, you know, they're not bleeding down. They're not going down to, you know, different levels where other people in their businesses might be doing. So for them, it would make perfect sense to align themselves with other players that would help them, you know, gain adoption in their SaaS play. And if you look at, you know, coming from the other opposite angle, if you have like a, you know, a cloud software provider or a service provider, you know, obviously it would be in their interest to align themselves with a business that requires a lot of resources. So to me, it just sounds like a good match.
Yeah.
I think what I'll add here is remembering what James said, I think in our first roundtable of this group, was he went to Salesforce's cloud computing system, and cloud was everywhere, cloud, 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 and it was an overcompensation that Salesforce really possibly isn't even a cloud. It's really just an application that exists on a bunch of their servers, which is good for them. But the fact is, it's not clear they really have that much cloud expertise.
Well, now they're filling the gaps.
Now they're trying to fill the gaps with...
So careful what you say before you know about deals that are coming.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, I mean, for many enterprises, Salesforce.com, like it or not, you know, marketing hype aside or not, is cloud computing and is their gate point, right? Their subscriptions to Salesforce are their cloud computing, and their Salesforce.com salesperson might well be the number one resource they have for cloud computing. So that's just reality for a lot of businesses.
I saw it really simply is that Spring is pretty much the number one enterprise web app development framework that's out there, a tool set. It's number one. And Salesforce's whole model is enterprises. I mean, at least medium-sized plus.
Sure.
So you cannot let those developers start to orchestrate or tie into other things. You can't give them a moment to turn their nose someplace else.
Right.
And this is an entirely, in my mind, a developer play to make sure that developers have an interesting sandbox, interesting deployment method, an interesting place to go write apps that tie into...
Right, and there's more than one. One of the things I was mentioning earlier with Adrian is that, you know, I think going back to the potential rumor about VMware and Engine Yard, and also looking at this Salesforce.com partnership with VMware and Google, people need to have the ability to handle... you know, bringing stuff into the cloud, whatever the architecture might be, whether it's a classic enterprise application that somebody wants to move into the cloud with as little change as possible, or whether it's taking an application and saying, hey, this thing has run its course, but we need to handle the workload. Let's rebuild it, maybe in a simplified Ruby on Rails manner with this engineered framework or this App Engine framework, and move forward with something that's going to last us 10 years going forward.
And I also think that just from some customer conversations I've had, that IT is under a lot more pressure this last year. And it hit home for me when a conservative company from Europe said to me, our business unit came to us and said, we need CRM in 3 weeks. And I think that these business guys have got this mindset that happened with cloud of it should just be an instant, it should be on. And
yeah.
That's going to present a market opportunity because now these IT guys were literally scrambling. Like, well, how do I write this up in 3 weeks? How do I write an app in 3 weeks?
If somebody can't get me a working demo and a sample account, like through my own visit to the website, I'm usually on to the next one, whatever that service might be.
So if they have a way for developers to integrate all their services together to write, you know, glue code on the top and to host it there directly to make it work faster, I think that's going to play into the faster and quicker ROI trend that's really going on in business buyers.
And if you look at, you know, Google App Engine having Python and Java and Engine Yard, you know, obviously, you know, covering the Ruby side, you really have what PHP left, right? And I think there was an announcement about PHP recently too, wasn't it?
That you found, Brian.
Yeah, so Heroku has announced a public, I believe a private beta of their PHP support. So a great case of a great technology company pulling themselves out of the Ruby ghetto.
What?
Oh man,
dude! I'm usually the
what just happened. I don't understand.
But you were quiet for the first few minutes.
Though. I had to.
James had to abstain. Yeah. So you know, yeah. I mean, I think the takeaway here is you can't, you know, say we're going to give this environment for certain people and but not do companies that are betting on cloud computing at scale need the flavor or the programming language or the framework across the board, and you're going to need multiple of them.
Exactly. I mean, Heroku, there's nothing about Heroku's core strategy that is Ruby. They're trying to bring cloud to the masses, all of the masses. The fact that they started with Ruby, because it's a great developer community and a great language and a great environment, they started there. Good for them.
Well, you call it the Ruby ghetto, but...
It's a very nice ghetto.
When Heroku talks, they admit that their developers are not that technical. they want to write an app on Facebook and make money for SuperPoke or some stupid sheep in your face.
And Tom Mornini from EngineYard, who was on the show a while back, said one of the fantastic things about Ruby is that people who might not have been classically trained computer science folks can, in a matter of weeks or months, start writing simple applications and really get up to speed far quicker than he's seen with any other computing language.
Right. I mean, so I think that actually plays into the Heroku model, because they're not going out and selling this to enterprises to host on their data center. I've talked to them occasionally back channel about that. I think they get asked to, but they're focused on the simplicity market.
And PHP plays into that. PHP is a great, simple, fast language.
So you think that's the next step up from Ruby in terms of simplicity and ease of use? You wouldn't put anything else in there?
I think it's a good second step. I mean, you've got the PHP guys and then the Ruby guys, and I think it's a great second beachhead from there. Whether there's someone in between or whether it's a spectrum, that's a complicated question.
Cool.
Elsewhere in the news, big announcement about HP cutting 9,000 jobs and investing $1 billion in cloud computing. But, you know, when I read this was like how do we do some financial shenanigans while promoting cloud computing and the whole thing? Digging into the news and all this, it really seemed to me to be a way to combine layoffs with a little promise more than anything else. But, you know, they're going to replace 6,000 salespeople to sell new services. So, I don't know. Did you guys take anything else away from this announcement?
Quick early thought. Isn't it funny that they really haven't mentioned cloud at all until this? So the first time they really talk about cloud is, as you say, during a layoff when they want to talk about something positive and growing.
Yeah. Now, I could flip that around. Many big companies, the likes of HP, you know, use themselves as showcases for their customers. Right? Cisco is famous for this. Right, Cisco will promote all the way they do their internal infrastructure and how they manage everything, whatever, and then sell that as a service. And particularly, you know, there's been a lot of articles now about even John Chambers and his management framework, and they're trying to do Cisco Learning Academy to sort of spawn this kind of stuff that they've done, much in the way that IBM, you know, educates customers and their best practices. And
so I think that's totally specious, and here's why. It's that I called James Governor out on this, and he tweeted, oh, hey, you know, it's automation, and that's helping them reduce jobs. That's bullshit, because if you read the announcement, it said that revenue was gradually trending down for the business unit that was affected, which means that they have less efficacy for their customers than they expected. Customers are decreasing demand for their services, which are probably generally overpriced and not delivering enough. So if you really are automating, then why is demand going down so fast? Because people that are automating, like Heroku, from get to deploy instantly, are growing pretty fast. So I think that the thing we have to do is not confuse cloud computing with automation, because cloud computing requires first sometimes a simplification. And you can't just whip it on in a legacy enterprise data center, call it cloud, and, you know, fire people.
Yeah. That's like cloud washing, isn't it?
That's cloud washing of the worst kind.
Elsewhere in the news, there was a ton of stuff. Google I.O. happened a couple of weeks ago. Ton of announcements there. The one I wanted to focus on was the announcement of the Google Storage Service. And obviously, they've had consumer-level things for a while. This seems to be their foray to compete with S3, which I think we'd all agree is sort of the dominant storage service today. Maybe I'm sure there's others. But what did you guys make of the Google Storage Service? Adrian, you've done a lot of work with a variety of the storage services. Did you have a chance to take a look under the covers?
Yeah, I mean, I tried it out, I guess, a few days ago, and it definitely is clearly an S3 clone. So they took the de facto API out there and threw it on top of their service. What was surprising to me is that that's what they did. Because if you look at the Google mentality, a lot of people will say, you know, they're going to create their own whatever that's better than what everybody else has created. In this case, it was a clear departure from that, where they have actually accepted the de facto standard, which is Amazon's S3 storage API, and slapped it on there, knowing full well all the follies of the past and like how somebody may have done it differently, you know, 3.5 or 4 years later. So to me, the most surprising thing is that they didn't create their own API.
Hmm. I think the important factor there is that they must realize by now that they are not winning this battle. They're not winning the cloud battle. They are, you know, kind of a distant third somewhere. I personally have never played with them even. You know, I go there occasionally and look at their news and, you know, do I want to play with this thing now? And oh, well, this really means I have to get in bed with Python and Java, and I can't go any further down the stack, and I'm kind of a low-level guy. So, you know, then I abandon it. But they must know that they're not ahead, so a certain amount of embrace and extend is in their future, and that's good for them that they've realized that.
I couldn't agree with you guys more. I was struck by it because I watched Adrian and Mitch Garnett talking about the API parity and how close it was, and it was pretty much a few region fields where all they were talking about is the difference. And I was like, what a validation that, you know, Google, the web company, comes
right
out and says to the bookstore company, your method of doing online storage is the right one, is the dominant design.
Well, it may not...
And they made it more expensive. They
right
didn't even do the classic Google
right
subsidy. It was 2 cents more for one.
I'm sure there's a, you could have an argument about whether or not it's the best or not the best technically. The fact of the matter is it's the most widely adopted, right?
That's what I mean by dominant design.
Okay, okay.
Studies of typewriters are that...
Right, the QWERTY keyword.
It's not the most efficient, but once it's dominant, you just go with it.
Right, yeah. I mean, they have it. They really never got into the... They never positioned infrastructure as a service in the early days, right? Their foray into cloud computing was really at the platform level with App Engine.
And then they took the quotas down on that. So they were always like a toe in the water, right? They're like, oh, we don't want to give away too much. It's too popular. And so I've always viewed them as not quite completely bought in. Like today, let me just hit on Google for a second. They put these damn pictures up.
Oh, you loved? Weren't you so excited about that?
Pissed about
it. Oh, you were?
Because it's just such an idea depravity that they've demonstrated, right? Like, they don't have any new ideas in S3. Now they're copying Bing's background picture images. I mean, they've hired too many people, and they have nothing to do. So they're copying S3.
Let me ask you guys a question. Does this infrastructure as a service stuff, whether it's Google Storage or maybe they'll even do a compute service, does it matter compared to the effort behind what they're doing with the Google Apps and trying to kill Office? I mean, is that really their fight that they've chosen, and this is just sort of filling in the gaps here and there?
I think it's a different fight, and one thing that you do get with Google is their expanse network of data centers and growing ones, where you could only consider maybe Microsoft as being the only like software producer and hoster that could be in that same like.
And you don't think Amazon range compares in terms of number of data centers and availability?
No, because I mean, if you look at the way that Microsoft launched their first product, they're already like at Amazon's level 4 years later. So, I mean, I may be wrong on this one, but the way I look at it is that, you know, it's going to be a fight for like data centers between Microsoft and Google.
And we're back to a real estate war. It'd be like hot dog stands at the corners of the street.
I mean, because think about it, data locality matters. And so
data locality matters, no doubt,
S3 API is just a toy, really. It's only a few methods, and it's very easy for people to implement. And Google are probably, like, you know, baning themselves, like, implementing this thing. They're like, God damn it, this thing is so, like, simple. We don't really want to, you know, work with this. It's not even, like, that elegant or whatever. But I wouldn't be surprised if they release another API on top of their same storage platform, you know, in the future.
Right.
But
it gives you some bells
and
whistles.
I don't think it matters, because if you have an app inside of, like, you know, Google App Engine, you're not going to call out to S3. You're going to cross data center boundaries and all this other stuff. So.
Right. But now, it was my understanding before this service, if you were building an app in Google App Engine, that you were, they had the mechanism to do that within App Engine, essentially getting a portion of, you know, the big table or the Google file system built in.
Think of it as like a small, medium, large. And so before Google's Blob Store API, which came out at the end of last year, I think, they had a, you know, just a normal like object persistence for application people, which was about like a megabyte or something like that.
Okay.
And then they have a Blob Store, which fills some of that gap. And this is more like, you know, another one. What was, I think the only reason why I was really surprised is that I guess I had confusion about their Docs API. And, you know, whether they were going to turn that into a Blob Store or whether they're going to...
Right, because they started accepting any file format
in
Google Docs.
And when I saw that, my Oracle was wrong, because I thought this was going to turn into, like, their next storage API system.
Right.
When it's really...
It's really
just
a different audience. I mean,
it's a totally different audience.
A developer's not going to, you know, they might do a hack on that. It's the same way people have hacked Gmail for photo storage.
Yeah, they're only going to hack it to use it for raw storage, but it's a good competitor to, like, a box.net or something.
Sure.
But it's a total different ball game, and I thought it might be an integrated solution, but I was wrong. They came out with Google
Storage. Google and integrated is sort of the wrong answer, right? They're still just all these little groups sort of running around fighting with each other.
Do they risk being the next Yahoo? So Yahoo was asked this week, like, what are you? And Carol
Last
Barth,
week, yeah.
Carol Barth was like,
500-word answer.
Yeah, hem-hawing people like Yahoo Finance. Yes, they do. They click on us sometimes. They didn't know anymore.
I think there is a risk of that. I had a lunch down there with a buddy, and they're really thinking hard about all the different little units they have.
A lunch at Google or a Yahoo?
At Google, because the food's so much better.
Yeah.
even if I had friends at Yahoo, I'd still want to have lunch at Google.
Yahoo has a good free chai latte. It's the best free chai latte.
They do have a nice free coffee stand. And those guys do a lot of work for cloud computing. And so even though their CEO might be confused about the essence of the company, I want to give Yahoo some kudos for all their efforts around Hadoop and all the other open source projects.
One of the best
meetups
in San Francisco.
Best meetups. And so kudos to those guys. Hey, you mentioned Box.net. Quick side note. They do host the Cloud Computing Show file, so we wanted to give a shout out to them. And they launched Sync today. So before it was just the, use the service and access it. But they launched Syncing today. I haven't had a chance to try it out. But if people want to try it out, go to Box.net to check that out.
Yeah, they're also involved in the jCloud stuff. So
they are.
Yeah, we're going to support Box.net as a blob store.
Nice.
So one of those hacks you were talking about earlier.
Yeah, I mean,
who would use that?
Those guys have an uncanny ability to just add all kinds of stuff in there. And if you read the interviews and stuff with their CEO, you know, it's always been about as many ins and outs as you can have to their system. So good for them. Hopefully that's going well. Brian, you picked up a story that you sent around earlier on Zynga. So why don't you fill us in on some of the background and we can have a discussion about that.
Sure. This was a more widely publicized story. I actually saw it in Salon, although it was hosted out of sourced out of GigaOm, that really talked about the way that Zynga approaches cloud computing. And what they said in their blog post is that they try out a game for a few months. And that first few months becomes they just don't know how big a game is going to be. So they start out on cloud, which is flexible, elastic, and everything else. And once they see the trajectory, then after those first couple months, they make their own data center choice about, hey, it's still ramping, we got to keep it in EC2 for a while. Or they say, hey, it's leveling off, it's a small fry, we'll keep it over here and we're going to port it over.
Bring it back to our own dedicated infrastructure where we can perhaps at steady state run it more efficiently.
Exactly. And it was unclear from the post and my understanding of Zynga how cloudy their internal infrastructure is, whether they've tried to really parallel the cloud environments of EC2 internally to try to make that porting easier or not. But I really like the idea that someone with as much traction and much experience as that they've had has this whole concept of we have to be public and private. Public has its benefits, private has its benefits, i.e. cost, really. Let's find a way to go back and forth and transition in order to get the levels of success and adoptability, as well as the and align that with or mash up that with the cost savings of going internal.
Right.
Interesting story.
Yeah, and this kind of underscores that cloud is not a one-way pattern. You can actually make a conscious decision that once you're out in cloud, that it's more efficient for you to have your own private resource pool, whether that's in a publicly hosted private cloud or your own infrastructure in some data center someplace.
You know, this is a theme that a lot of people talk about, that you should always start, if you're starting new and you don't really know what it's going to be, start in the cloud because you get all those benefits of low cost, variable pricing, elasticity, you name it.
I think the real money question here, though, is could Zynga have existed 3 years ago before cloud? Because that's something I've been thinking about a lot, is when can applications start to exist that they might not have before? Because that's a truly paradigm shift in terms of what you can bring to market.
I know some of the guys over at Zynga, and one thing that I'd say about that is that, at least a year ago, they weren't that much into cloud, honestly. Like, EC2 was only running a couple of their games, and each of their studios were making different decisions about how they would operate. So I don't think it was like a existential, cloud versus non-cloud. And this is another point I have on the right scale stuff with Zynga, is that I don't actually think that it's like one making the other possible, it's just a good match. Like if you look at it, it's just, you know, one's focused on, you know, having studios produce games and not introduce a lot of risk, and the other one is like, you know, taking care of infrastructural issues that happen to be cloud related right now.
Yeah.
And, you know, one thing that I think they have to be more concerned about than, you know, the cloud computing side of it is the demise of Facebook and the popularity of the users. You know, because as people, you know, exit Facebook, I really am very curious about.
So there were all those rumors a couple of weeks back about, you know, whether they were going to have their own platform, and they used that threat to negotiate with Facebook about the percent of advertising revenue they're going to get, or this whole thing. I mean,
I don't think they get a lot of revenue out of ads, actually. I think that it's mainly about when, you know, you hear a lot of people just, you know, talking about how they don't like, you know, Facebook policies nowadays.
Right.
And that I think is actually a significant threat. I mean, what the next platform is, or maybe the, you know, tri or quad platform, you know, wherever the next Mafia Wars is hosted out of, I think it's about mitigating the difference, you know, between being bound to like a Facebook, which is sort of like the de facto social app for games, and, you know, being your own entity. And I think they are their own entity, but I think they're still very, very tied to, like, you know, E.T. Eliot version of
right,
you know, sharing the same fate in the cloud. And
that's
so,
because Mafia Wars would be, and I've only tried it for a week just to try.
I've never tried it, so
but just an experiment. Mafia Wars was already a little boring, but it would be dead boring if your friends weren't also playing it.
Right.
And that's really what's interesting about Zynga, is they take things that are boring as hell and they make them interesting because your friends are there.
Right.
Yeah, and they do it extremely well.
Yeah.
So to me, a lot of this just has to do with the cycles of the game industry. I mean, the game industry has been out there for a long time. There's a lot of faddism. There's the hot designer, the hot studio, and somehow they get the alchemy in there. So some of Zynga's success is just they hit that right.
They hit that right. I mean, there's been waves, right? There's console waves back, you know, earlier.
So
there
it's
was
like Facebook the
wave.
Next console for games? Is that, you know?
Potentially.
I think it's the previous one. I think there's actually one coming up pretty soon.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
I'll say at the low level is it, in the high scalability article about Zynga that came out before the GigaOM one, is that they have one write for every three reads, which is pretty sick for an 80 million person web app. That's a lot of hitting the back end.
Yeah, I mean,
you're saying that's a high write load, read load?
Right. I mean, in terms of
high write load?
Yeah, if you're
3 to 1,
normal,
you're saying it's a high write load?
Well,
I'm not disagreeing with you, I'm just clarifying.
New York Times, when you're 80 million people are reading that, right?
Sure.
That's just all reads.
Sure.
Well, I'll actually give you a different number out of a different social networking game of similar type, which was 99 to 1.
Reads
right?
To write.
99 reads to one write. I mean, that's a common kind of...
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
And
this
plenty
is...
of games get by with that because, you know, hey, you're wandering around inside the
exactly.
room and everyone else is wandering around inside the room.
And you don't do
what
that
do you
much.
What do you need to write for? I mean, it's all read, 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 read,
right.
read.
So, but here's a question about the cloud computing, you know, public dedicated question, because I thought the Zynga stories that came out presented that in a pretty clear manner. Why... is that the case? Why is it the case that somebody who is the scale of an Amazon, even if I have, I mean, how exotic is that workload to where I'm going to do it for that much lower cost in my own infrastructure? You know, we all talk about cloud's a great place to start, but at a certain point, the operating bill, the monthly bill gets too high, the bandwidth costs are too much, and you have to move back to a dedicated infrastructure. Why is that the case?
Quick comment?
Do it.
Adrian, when S3 launched, how much was it per gigabyte? 15 cents. So it's like 3 years later, and how much is it per gigabyte? 15 cents. So my thing I've been saying, and I believe this, no matter my affiliation or background, is that Amazon recently announced that they're hiring an enterprise marketing manager for the cloud. And I immediately got pissed off on Twitter to Jeff Barr and retweeted, who's the enterprise marketing manager for Wheat? And Jeff hilariously walked right into my trap and went, wheat? I was like, yeah, you know one of those commodities? Who's its enterprise marketing manager? So I think the truth is that Amazon has been playing off the novelty and the usefulness of what they've built to pull margins out of it, which allows them to fund SG&A like enterprise marketing managers. If it's a true commodity, like who's the marketing manager for rice?
Well, they do have a Rice, you know,
yes,
lobbying group and
Rice
everything.
The Rice Marketing Board. I'm sure that there's
a Rice Marketing Board somewhere
out there.
Yes, you can catch me on that corner case. But that's the huge aggregate of everyone, and they chip in 1%. We're talking on this, they're hiring, you know, 100 new marketing people for one producer.
Well, I mean, I got to say that I don't believe in the prices that we're seeing today for infrastructure at all.
You don't? In what way don't you believe in them?
Well, okay, because, you know, if you watch the Easy Mobius Twitter stream from Ezra over at EngineYard, you see all sorts of, like, tweets about launching, like, 700 nodes or whatever
on a
60-cent-an-hour server. So do the math, right? That's less than a tenth. You know, it's so small compared to this 8 or 9 cents of business that you get for the M1 small, which you can't do anything with. So if I can get a server that I can't do anything with for 8 cents or a tenth of a cent, I'd probably choose I can't do anything with the 0.1%, right? So I, the first thing that came to my mind with your question is that, like, I just don't believe in the pricing. I don't think it's correct.
You think it should be lower?
Much.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's correct for them right now.
They've got enough monopoly in essence that they're in. What surprises me about what they're doing is they're investing in a marketing org. Right, they're saying long term we want margins in this like a software company.
Is it a free market?
At least a hardware company.
No. So look, if that theory was true, then you would see every other cloud provider without their name at lower prices.
Right? Rackspace starts at a penny and a half.
Let's talk about machines you can actually do something with. Let's talk about an Amazon Large.
With M1. Okay. All right.
Let's talk about an M1 Large.
Okay.
I think that the Rackspace price is what, 20 or 30% higher.
For those who don't know what an M1 server, I mean, you're saying the servers that are substantial that you can do real work on, run real apps, those pricing seems to be, there seems to be more commonality. They're in a tighter price band across providers.
Well, Amazon itself has two price bands. They have your, you know, give it to me forever price, and then they have their spot market price, which, well, I've never had a spot instance ripped out from under
me. Yeah, but it's pretty cheap.
So there's the 50% discount. Mm-hmm. And then the regular price, which means to me that there's games going on in this market. I completely agree. There's way too much.
I don't think it's a free market now, only in that Amazon has cornered so much mind share and developer mind share. And you know, if you go to do a proposal to somebody or go to raise money with a VC in Silicon Valley and they say, where are you going to do your infrastructure? If you don't say, oh, it's on Amazon EC2, you're going to get grilled on, you know, why did you pick this one over that one? It's like a battle not worth having.
Classically, I've looked at their reserved instance price, which is for a year or 3 years, is, you know, at least 50% less than their hourly. And I can't imagine them selling a three-year deal that's incredibly underwater. So I generally approximate that somewhere near within 5% of their cost. Because why would they do a three-year deal that loses 25%? I don't think they would. Maybe I'm wrong.
Well, here's my second point. Let's look at the Kindle. It's not really clear that Amazon plays fair when they're doing pricing. They really have a view of markets and the view of market pricing where they are willing to subsidize like crazy to make markets happen. So just taking Kindle as an example, I think we can say that they might very well be writing three-year underwater contracts.
They might, and people have told me that. It is my belief that should be within about 5%, that they're not going to be 15% underwater on those. But maybe they're counting on upsells in other places. That's very likely, but the most rational explanation I've seen is somewhere around that payment.
Yeah.
Well, I think the homework for those listening is to look at the Cloud Harmony blog that has a performance comparison with the prices aligned, and you could do simple math calculations on either processor or I/O performance, and at least see what people are offering as services, and then, you know, some aggregate tests. And I think that you're going to find that it's kind of random if you look at the prices. You're right. I think at the top end, it's less random. But definitely at the low end, it's pretty random. But the other thing I might mention about it is does it matter? So the companies that aren't running 100, 1,000 nodes probably don't care about the $30 versus $70 a month or whatever that might be. And I think it's going to be the more successful companies like your Zynga's that actually makes a material difference. Because
12,000 is the number they quote.
Yeah.
Well, big companies are going to have, you know, analysts doing cloud pricing the same way that they have buyers who are analyzing whatever they're getting, you know, in the supply chain.
Sure.
And that full-time job is going to be bargaining between one and the next.
Which is why things like networking devices barely carry any margin, because there's so much competition. Those bastards carry 70% margins.
Well, supposedly they're next, right? First we do storage, then we do compute, then we do networking. So
once people have preferences,
always last,
man, right? Money will be made.
Yeah, you know, I'm a big fan of the whole networking arena. I think it gets wildly underplayed, and that people think that 10,000 servers just magically coalesce without having to have a smart infrastructure there.
It's a network that makes people live in these fantasies, right? Because if it weren't so awesome, then they would actually have to pay attention.
Right.
So it's the most powerful statement, is you don't really pay attention to networks with these cloud services.
Right. James, you had a mention before to put into the notes, James Hamilton's well-known video on efficiencies and scalability in the cloud. Give us some of your background thoughts on there, because you know a lot of people know of James Hamilton. We're all big fans.
So we only do these about every 2 months, but it was about a month ago when this came out, and it's a pretty cool piece where he goes through what it really costs to run a data center and how they're driving costs down and what the efficiencies of a very large cloud are. And he goes through how much margin they can take out versus a small provider. So he gives the example of he used to do Microsoft email as a service, which is about a $40 million startup,
mm-hmm.
$40 million in revenue. He's paying 80% more for storage and bandwidth than what he pays today,
right,
at Amazon scale. So that was his first thesis. And then the second thesis was essentially that to build and cool data centers, it made a lot more sense to make it big. So I encourage everyone to take a look at that. The questions that it raises for me, though, are, is this going to be this what I call black hole clouds? Which is that, do you just get more and more efficiency as you get bigger and bigger and just build to the sky, because eventually you don't even notice the nominal cost of a server versus a small guy who's got to think about the people and what they're doing with that. And I think that's something I wanted to toss out to the team, which is, do we see this being two big clouds in the United States long term? Do we see regional clouds having an impact? And then finally, probably one of the most interesting engineering things that Hamilton raised was that networking was really a pain in a big scale data center. He said you get poor efficiencies when you build really big switch networks, and that eventually you don't have enough bandwidth to move things from one side of the data center to the other to balance out load, and that was his biggest problem. So these were all just very interesting. If you care about cloud economics, these are mm-hmm. these are fundamental puzzles you should be thinking about at night.
And he's a really sharp cracker and really breaks it down to sort of the bare essentials and the necessities there.
Yeah.
So we'll put a link to that in the show notes. I was watching again the intro, and he talks about how going from property to building cost to land cost to water cost. To me, it seems maybe similar. We always come up with all these different. What are the analogies for the cloud market? I do think it's going to coalesce. I don't know if it's 2, 3, 4, 5, but I mean, look how many car companies we have in the U.S. They all ultimately failed, and now the new crop comes in. But, 100 auto companies in 1900 and 4 or 5 and 1990 or whatever it was.
Yeah.
So.
One other comment there is that James shows a nice pie chart, which everyone that cares about cloud should look at, which says 55% of the cost is servers. So essentially it all comes down to how efficiently you can maximize those server utilization. Mm-hmm. Here's the catch. Given the way they do networking, they don't dynamically redeploy in a clustered fashion. No one believes that they do, like balancing what the load is, the actual load, not the reserve load, on one machine to the other. So they do not have like what data center virtualization, which has like distributed resource scheduling, which maximizes everything out. So the interesting question is, long term, will people want to do that kind of scheduling to move hot VMs around, or is this sort of fixed in place boot and stay model going to persist?
It's interesting to talk about moving VMs around. I think it's important, but we got to have enough VM penetration before. I think that's a little
bit
of.
You don't think Amazon has enough?
Well, I think Amazon has enough, sure, but there, how many people have that level of penetration, right? It's going to take a few more years before we get significant penetration in terms of the percentage of virtualized loads before we really have to start taking migration as a core competence. I'm not doubting that it will happen. I'm just saying it's easy to conceptualize that now and talk about it as a technology fan, but in reality, people have to virtualize stuff first before they move it around. So that's my two takes.
My Oracle stake on the moving things around in a data center, it's not going to happen primarily at the OS layer. It's just, it's the wrong layer to do it at.
Makes sense.
Because you got a transaction in flight, right? Some poor sap is in front of his browser waiting for God knows what. And you're going to move the entire operating system and pretend that all the transactions are completely transparent and all the interdependent pieces of a given experience are suddenly going to pause for how many seconds as you move the entire operating system?
Well, not to plug the building's technology we have, but with vMotion, you can do that with a live running service with no impact. And this is what customers love about VMware's data center stuff. And they can do it across pretty large clusters and have live services running the whole time, which lets you stack things in. And I think that's going to, in the near term, give some smaller-ish clouds a fighting chance if they get more efficiency out of their infrastructure, given where the VM prices are that we talked about.
Well, if we rip this back in the cloud specifically, and there are earlier discussions about the platforms that are solidifying, you know, the engine yards and the Google App Engines and everything else, it gets back to Brian's point, because if you have the option to take it at the platform level as opposed to the OS level, or better yet, the SaaS level, then, man, I mean, your efficiencies are going to be great.
Well, ideally, you do it at the service level, the service composition level, which is what Brian's saying. Totally agree. I just think clouds right now are a heterogeneous junkyard of random VMs. It's hard to do it like that.
Yeah. Well, I think there's a coming war, really, between those two approaches, and that this is one of the fundamental differences between IIS and PIS, right? When you see it as a platform and a transaction can be migrated as a transaction, as opposed to the entire VM,
yeah.
I mean, that this is one of the coming wars, and I think platform is going to win, and you know, the Herokus and Engine Yards and App Engines are going to be the winners.
There we go. We'll follow up with that in our annual roundup. So a couple other little bits that we had. Brian, you'd found a thing about Amazon enhancing their S3 management interface.
It was really a very simple, short item, but the one way to look at this is that Amazon's prowess in the cloud field marches on, that, you know, not a week goes by without an improvement in their interfaces and infrastructure, and how much all the companies that have sprung up around making EC2 easy to use and easy to manage, how much lifetime do they really have, given that Amazon is this massive juggernaut? But I can also turn that completely on its side and say, oh, so their big announcement was they got a UI on top of their file manager.
Right.
I mean, my home NAS has that, and you know, it costs $400.
What home NAS do you have?
I have a QNAP.
A QNAP.
Not a Linksys.
I have.
Fortera.
I have the. I can't remember the name of it now.
Buffalo Terra Station.
No, it's the. It's the router maker, the home
Linksys.
Router.
Linksys. No, Netgear.
Netgear. I have the Netgear. Sorry, they have a great brand, but I just can never remember it.
Well, you know, Netgear, what are you going to say? Yeah. Network gear.
Well, one thing I say is that the companies who are adding value on top of EC2 or S3 or whatever, and if they're still today threatened by a web GUI on S3 or EC2 or whatever, CloudFront for that matter, then, you know, meritocracy, guys, you better die. Because if 3 years later, the best value you can offer is a GUI on top of S3, forget about it. But what I think that is going to be more interesting is that the most adopted tooling is very good at this stuff. So if you look at like the, you know, the S3 Fox, the, you know, Elastic, you know, APIs for you know, Firefox and plugins, the CyberDucks and all these guys, they do this and then some. And you know, I recently saw a CyberDuck, which was much more exciting to me than the S3 GUI thing, because they do like SFTP, web dev, you know, Rackspace, you know, Amazon, all this stuff. And, you know, it's so, so very simple that anybody could use it. And it's still a fat app, but still they're more
name
than
of that again?
CyberDuck.
CyberDuck?
Yes.
Yeah, we'll have a link to that.
Probably the poster child for, like, the data
notes.
Integration app that's very accessible to people
but
who don't care.
Let me ask you a strategic question. How do they ever get ahead? Because today, you know, I saw again, RightScale sent me this email. Here's our new features. And it listed out all of the features that came on Amazon a month and a half or 2 months ago.
Okay.
They've essentially now integrated.
The lag, right?
Yeah. Which I understand. It takes time to integrate that in their platform. But how do they ever get ahead and truly have abstract new technology if they're always essentially like running behind the elephant, scooping up features and being redirected architecturally as they go?
Well, isn't the ability to take that single console across multiple providers really one of the core elements?
They have never demonstrated that that's their business plan.
Yeah, I mean, they talk about it and, you know, people think about it, but yeah, you're right. It tends to be dedicated to a single cloud.
From a feature standpoint, I mean, if you think about like how you would act in like a managed hosting company, if this weren't cloud, product engineering comes after the product happens.
Yeah.
So essentially, the way I look at Rightscale is that they're really a product engineering company, and so you've got a feature that's released by, you know, in this case most often Amazon. Yeah, there's going to be a lag because they're, you know, trying to engineer a way to provide a support behind it. And I think that the difference, though, is that Amazon, unlike some other companies, you know, they do, when they announce it, it actually works, right? So it's not like, you know, you've got this like time and there's no software available or whatever else like that. It's, you know, they announce it, the endpoints are there, like about 3 hours before, like George Reese might have told you that it's there.
Yeah,
Mitch Garnett is on, right?
Mitch will provide support in Boto that same day for anything on Amazon. So why it takes Rightscale 2 months, I question.
Yeah,
that's a fair question. Good question.
Well, that is a lot of news coverage. And
is that all news?
Yeah, that was all sort of in our newsy section. I wanted to save at least one or two topics for roundtable discussion. And the first one that I wanted to start with is DevOps, this merging of development and operations. And the question is, first we'll talk about sort of what is it and so forth, but the real question for discussion is, why is it so contentious? And why does it become such a hot topic?
Can I just say I'm glad that for once Adrian's going to be in the hot seat?
Adrian can be in the hot seat.
I am always in the VMware News Fryer, and now he has to have a stake in the game.
Okay.
On this topic.
So why don't you explain that bit of sarcasm there to the audience. Give us your definition of DevOps, and maybe kick off the conversation, Adrian, about why is it so contentious?
Right. Well, I'd say my definition of DevOps as it changes, but today it's that job description you didn't have before. You know, I've actually been in a room with my former management, and you know, the question is, what exactly do you do? Because you know, here you are, you know, you're orchestrating systems and all of that. I get that, but you're also in the development team. And I don't have a job title for that. And before it was a scary thing, now it's a great thing, right? Because this is the movement where you actually take the idea of development practices, things that have been improved, and you know, apply that to the way that you do operations. So if in the past you had separate roles, separate structures, separate philosophies, management chains, everything it would be different between the way you do your software development lifecycle and your operations lifecycle. This is where they converge, and you know, when you look at the impact of that, you end up with people looking at a different tool set than they used to be using. Like, so for example, you might have, you know, someone writing a shell script, and you know, because they happen to know the intricacies of their environment, it might be like 30 machines. They are able to write a shell script to do that. And so DevOps is really a way to take the scale that people have to consider in software environments and apply that to operations. The impact for developers are, in this role, because nothing's ever free, is that developers now need to be a little bit more aware of their environment. So cloud computing did a lot of this because, you know, at least now you have to know the operating system, the image, the size, the machines that your app is going to run on. But, you know, in the future, I wouldn't be surprised if you have to pay a lot of attention to edge devices. And the DevOps tools in this space actually, you know, take care of all these things.
Right. In some sense, cloud computing forced this whole initiative because you didn't have access to stuff. And so you had to come up with mechanisms to automate. Yes? Is that a fair statement?
I'd say it's more like lean startup helped this along. Because if you don't have the funds to hire a separate operations staff that happen to already be good at all this stuff, then now you actually have, at least from a grassroots movement, folks that need to take multiple roles, and they're probably already immersed in agile methodology, which wasn't the case 10 years ago. So I think it was sort of like the right timing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a perfect storm for DevOps to actually succeed.
It's industrialization. It's the same thing that we do with infrastructure. We're doing it with configuration and other things. It's just industrialization is the common theme here, interchangeable parts and processes of assembly.
And in some sense, whenever you automate, you create jobs. You create the jobs of the guy running the automation machinery. Okay, maybe you shifted some guy over from dev, but you got to have this thing, the guy who runs the automation machinery, not just the guy who runs the machinery. It's completely natural, and it's contentious because as soon as you start changing these walls, you've got internal fiefdoms. And, of course, that's going to, you know, cause strife.
And Adrian gave what I would call the conservative view, and I think there's also, like, the firebrand wing, like a John Allspaugh, who said once, if you're not deploying 8 times a day, you're just not there yet. And that, I think, is the wing of DevOps, where developers literally are that close to ops that they can deploy code that often and that responding to how things are behaving, that starts to get security and high-end risk management to thinking ops people going, whoa, you're going to deploy 8 times a day? I mean, that's a pretty serious quote to throw out there. And he runs
right.
a very large web property, so he believes in it.
Some people go to even a more aggressive schedule than that, with continuous deployment. There's a blog post about WordPress.com, I believe, and about their deployment schedule, which is fast and furious.
Yeah.
The idea is that this whole stuff is there to reduce your risk, so that you don't have to worry about what's going to happen. Like, there's no magic sauce that somebody had happened to, like, monkey into a shell script or whatever else it is that's actually holding everything together. And also that since the release cycles are smaller, you know, that the chances for people deviating between the last release are very low. So, I mean, you know, in the more conservative alphas I've worked at, you know, you had real fear in between last release and this release,
yeah.
because you know your ops team who had great, you know, they may have been developers themselves. It's not necessarily that they're not developers. It's just that they've had to put in so many interim patches that may not have been regressioned properly or whatever. So it's just about tighter cycles, and that's what you get. You end up with, the opposite would be, you know, a quote I kind of tweeted today, which was that, you know, yeah, I deployed software once when the usual sysadmin was out, and I really hated KSH. Like, that's the opposite of DevOps. If I can sum it up to that, that's it.
One experience I had at a customer site recently, they recently flipped from being very deploy 3 times a day, you know, make a mistake and then get it on and off the servers really, really fast. And that's the way we keep moving forward, to a very risk averse. They had a little bit of changes in personnel, but also they started attracting some customers who were demanding mm-hmm. much higher service agreements, things of that nature. And they suddenly went to, oh my gosh, you know, I want you to spend 2 weeks building a simulator for our system, which of course was then never perfect because, well, it's a simulator. And it was a very jarring experience to go from the, you know, okay, we try it, we fix it, we try it, we fix it, we try it, we fix it. And testing just becomes the unit level as per Agile, as opposed to sort of an old school waterfall method. They really are still just that far apart.
We did a SaaS installation not too long ago, and they had a staging area where we had to do stuff before we went to production. It was a pain, I felt, for the app that we were dealing with, which wasn't necessarily a sort of mission-critical app. There was certainly room to roll something back, in my opinion. So I just know from the end-user perspective of signing up for a SaaS service and then having them tell me that we have to go through a staging server and then not every variable or setting was going to carry over, I was scratching my head saying, why am I doing the staging server? It just didn't make sense to me.
Well, I mean with systems like Chef and all, the idea is that you've centralized all of that monkeying that you've had to do in the past. But the thing that's really a changer about it isn't necessarily like the software you're using, is that you have all the pieces at the right maturity at the right time. So it's not like you just have this one product that's before its time and really awesome that like 5 people know how to use. It's that they're pretty much de facto ways of operating. And not only that, but you layer cloud on top of it. So the idea of getting an environment to test this out is increasingly capable for people. So, I mean, DevOps is the perfect storm today. That's why it's here today. That's why we're hearing about it today. That's why we're not hearing about it, you know, several years ago, is that we didn't have, you know, the maturity of cloud where developers can spin up nodes. It will even get better. I mean, next year when you have more private clouds, more like cloud on laptop type of stuff, it's only going to get better.
They're both infrastructure as code. I mean, John Willis from OpsCode
yep.
has the great thing he's been saying for over a year, give him credit, infrastructure as code. And both cloud and DevOps really comply to that, and I love it as a tagline. It's the most succinct thing I've heard, which is that it's not a series of idiosyncratic configuration scripts, it's code.
Right. Well, that is certainly going to be a theme that we'll get a lot of attention for the rest of this year, and we'll have you know who to keep us in the loop on that. I'm watching the clock, and we're coming up on an hour, so I want to move to the final sections of the show. Meetups, is there a San Francisco Cloud Computing meetup coming up, James?
I haven't held a cloud club in a while. We should probably have one. It's just been busy in the cloud lately. So, Brian, are you in?
I'm in, absolutely.
Adrian? I'm in, yeah.
In?
There'll at least be us then.
Okay, great. So we'll try to get that going.
And there's a DevOps days, the last day, after Velocity, so Velocity ends on a Thursday. There's a DevOps day on that Friday, hosted by Patrick Dubois, who, if anybody's actually done any research on DevOps, he's definitely a good player and a great audience and lots of participants. So if anyone's curious about like what this DevOps stuff is, definitely just just search DevOps days and check it out. Next opportunity would be in Europe. So
I'll be at DevOps Day. I'm excited.
The Thursday looks like it's June 24th by this calendar.
So Friday
the 25th.
Yep. So excited about it. I think we're even sponsoring part of this.
Excellent. Now, you were at GlueCon. Yep. Were either of you there?
Couldn't make it.
Looked like a great con.
Give us a quick synopsis and your thoughts.
Much better than I expected.
Really?
Great.
Why? What made it so good?
It's always the audience. It's always the who's there with you. When you look at like the best times you ever had is the people there, not necessarily the surroundings. And it's funny because some people like elbow GlueCon about like their logos and stuff, and maybe it's not the best presented, whatever. But I tell you what, it was a great time, and there were really smart people there, asked great questions. And, even the folks that you wouldn't expect to enjoy their talks had great talks. I don't know, it was the sun was in the right spot, but there were a lot of very high-quality people and a lot of high-quality presentations.
It's more of a developer crowd, though, isn't it, than your standard, like, big logo? Was there anything, was it more developer-oriented?
I can't completely agree with that because you had Microsoft there, you know, It wasn't just developer crowd. It wasn't a huge conference, but so to put it down into points about why I was interested, being more cloud than anything else, there were a lot of the usual suspects there, making great talks, advancing their talks that they had done before. Like for example, Mitch Granat had a great talk on Amazon Web Services and has some great comparisons of different services.
He's so good when you watch him talk. He's one of those guys that has no interest in marketing himself. Like, he literally was bashful on Twitter. He's just a knowledge guy.
Mm. Yep, and Azure had the last session of the conference, and they actually made it interesting. It was one of the tech guys that had been underneath of the covers, and normally you'd expect a really awkward presentation, but it was good. And it basically showed something that I think a lot of people haven't been paying much attention to, which is Microsoft's approach to going to the top of the top of the stack. So they're already talking about data as a service. I want to lease this data set that I've parsed with my 1,000-node Hadoop cluster so you don't have to. Like, it's that level. So, when you look at presentations like that, I just think it's great stuff. For guys like me and you, I think, definitely next year go to GlueCon.
Damn it.
Well, we got next year. Thanks for that report. And, of course, we've been talking about it for a long, long time now, but week of the 21st, we have the back-to-back Velocity and Structure shows, which should be a lot of fun. So I'll be at both. If we get a chance to say hi in person to anybody, let's try to do that. And
I'm lucky enough to be speaking at Structure this year.
And James is speaking at Structure. So what's your panel?
It's the future of the data center and what happens after Blades. And that's why this James Hamilton speech is very interesting to me, because it's going to be a little bit of an argument from these new guys like Tylera that are trying to solve efficiency at the chip level. And the more I look at it, and I'd love to talk to you guys before it, it really comes down to server utilization is the biggest gun that you have. But, programmer productivity, I'll share a quick data point that I saw around this.
Sure.
Facebook released that they had rewritten a lot of their services underneath the covers in C++.
Right. There was a tool, HipHop.
HipHop. Now, here's the thing, though, is they said, we get 70 times more CPU efficiency now that we've written in C++ than PHP. 70x. So I guess my thought is that there's already ways out there that if you take all these popular web languages and you truly recompile the services into C++ or something very low level, you can already get 70x. So now you're going to tell me that you're going to introduce a new chip, which you have to recompile. I think it's just so
I could make the same argument about, do you need virtualization then if you're getting, you know, all that bang for your buck?
You have to have virtualization because to drive in a heterogeneous, remember,
for other reasons.
In a heterogeneous workload environment, you have to have virtualization to cram as many servers as possible onto a cluster. There's no other way. And I believe you have to balance them across the cluster. But yeah. So anyway, that'll be good, and hopefully I'll have interesting news.
Excellent. Time for our last section of the show, Cloud Tips, where we provide a favorite product, service, company, link, something related to cloud computing. Anybody ready to go?
Cloud Harmony.
James picks Cloud Harmony. Give us Adrian talked a little bit about it before, but give us another synopsis there.
So fantastic. Everyone's been just living in dark around true performance in the cloud, and they did some nuts and bolts, thankless work to go out and set up test unit tests and tests everywhere across the cloud on every kind of server. Anytime there's any service downage, they know about it first. These guys are all over the cloud right now and testing the S out.
Downage is a technical term.
I have been having a little bit of supplied wine, and I apologize.
Brian, your cloud tip.
Okay, my cloud tip is going to be the people from my segment, there's been a lot of activity of releases within Elastic database technology, and I'm going to call out three. One is, and they're all competitors of mine, so you know that's hopefully a good thing. The first one is MongoDB. So MongoDB did a great demonstration 3 weeks ago of a huge cluster running in Amazon EC2 using their new auto sharding technology. Now, I'm not a shard guy. I'm a cluster guy. I think clusters are better than shard, But I got to admire their guts for putting their
was this
their
the 8 million responses per second test that they...
That's what they showed. And I want to dig in. Yeah, it's impressive. So they released something there that's in the storage, cloud database, Elastic database arena that's worth checking out. They've got a lot of traction these days as well. The second thing to note is I noticed Riox Basho put out a new community release, 0.11. I'm not sure quite what's in it yet, but it's great to see them out there and pushing the envelope. And then the third thing is sort of a little bit of a dark horse is, unless you know the background, company called VaultDB. They are one of the Michael Stonebreaker database companies, and they recently released their community edition as well. So they are a full Elastic SQL based system. And all of us who are working in Elastic databases, including Citrus Leaf, it's really important that people know that even though today's storage and today's cloud is all about MySQL, there's a whole thundering herd out there of solutions, and I suggest that you check out Mongo and VaultDB and Riok as well as Citrus.
And so Vault was still SQL compliant, so you could still...
So they say. I mean, everyone says, I mean, look, you try to migrate just between Postgres and Oracle, and you know, you end up breaking your fingers off. So SQL compliant, and then there's SQL compliant.
Okay.
Adrian.
So I would say the second huge surprise to me in a year, where the first one being...
But you have a stable life.
Well, no, this is a big surprise. The first big surprise being really liking Microsoft Azure. This one is actually liking the IBM Developer Cloud. Considering it's such a big company, I wanted to hate it. And, But one thing I really like about that is, as a cloud API guy, they're the only company that has a cloud API that allows you to know exactly what's in your image and know ahead of time, like things like parameters to my SQL user or whatever else like that, which is normally platform land, but they've actually taken enough steps to start in there so that if you wanted to like create an image that on anyone's GUI would look right, like they would have the right fields to form, forms to fill in, or if I need to specify this IP range it's allowed to access it, they actually have a standardized way of handling that. So it's very, very innovative compared to all the other cloud
providers. So a much deeper, a richer API than elsewhere.
For image providers.
For image providers.
So say I'm a you know, virtual appliance provider and I want to, you know, create a firewall, say I'm F5 or whatever. I could actually specify that you need to enter in, you know, the admin account, the, you know, host range that you want. And guess what? Because anybody who's using this API has this data, their GUI, without knowing anything about your F5 appliance, is going to know what those fields are, just like an XML schema is going to have, and be able to interact with it. So it's the first API that actually gives you insight into the image. And, you know, to me, you know, and, you know, being in a lot of IIS providers, this is the big question mark. It's like, okay, what operating system user does this thing have? Does it even have root? I have no idea. They never tell you. But IBM Dev is the first one I've encountered, and there may be others, but it's the first one I encountered that actually lets you know the answer to that question.
Excellent. My cloud tip for the week, there's been a lot of activity around HTML5. This isn't directly connected to HTML5, but for now, for those folks who are doing web work, this ability to embed fonts that are hosted elsewhere, I think is really, really neat, because now you can have a really rich-looking page, and yet it's all searchable and scannable and SEO-able and so forth. And so this is all hosted. Just sign up and you embed the stuff. So
hosted
the company
fonts.
Hosted fonts.
Holy shit.
I'm yeah. writing fonts on the board right now.
Fonts.
I can't believe you just got
well, I'm the
right.
design guy, so. So the
Google's release was part of that too, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah,
they're
yeah.
actually the ones hosting the fonts.
They're hosting
and
a bunch
they
of stuff, yeah.
And actually
so the
bought fonts and
yeah.
font design and they're putting in public
I just think it's going to.
Fonts as a service?
Fonts as a service. So fonts as a service, my pick is Typekit. And you know, super simple, and I think super neat as far as you know, we get to this whole HTML5. Did you see the demo that Apple put up about HTML5 in the little showcase there? I just thought that was pretty neat about the stuff that's coming down the pike there. So that's my pick. That's it for cloud tips. We do have a special announcement on the show. Summertime coming up here, and the Cloud Computing Show is looking for a summer intern to do a little bit of podcast administration. Probably something that would be perfect for a high school student with some free time over the summer that likes computers, that likes social media. If anybody has a reference or family member that's interested, drop us a line, and we'd be happy to share more info there. So that's the wrap. Let's give a little shout-out individually for where people can find us, Twitter address, blogs, anything else that you'd like to say. James, we'll start with you.
Yeah, sure. You can find James Waters at WatersJames with two T's on Twitter. And if you want to read my blog, it's watersjames.posterous.
Love posterous.
Super easy. And I kept the handle the same. Isn't that easy? Like WatersJames, WatersJames.
WatersJames.
Email, WatersJames.
That's pretty good branding. Brian.
Beeble Cow at Twitter, but check Citrus Leaf out at citrusleaf.net.
Adrian.
Adrian F. Cole at Twitter, also at JClouds or anything else JClouds related.
And Gary Orenstein, you can find me on Twitter with the full name Gary Orenstein. We'll have all those links in the show notes. Anything else before we close out that we missed this week?
Adrian got engaged.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Well, thanks very much to our listeners. You can visit us at thecloudcomputingshow.com or email us at thecloudcomputingshow@gmail.com. You can also subscribe on iTunes or search for The Cloud Computing Show. And you'll click through and you'll be able to find a link to the show. We also have a direct link in the show notes at thecloudcomputingshow.com for iTunes. And I just want to give a note out. We have a couple of exciting shows coming up. Week of June 21st, we have Simple Geo and Joe Stump there, who's a geolocation and a big data expert. So that'll be really exciting. And then looks like end of June, early July, we're going to have Couch.io, the folks behind CouchDB that are doing a lot of cool stuff there in the database arena, particularly with mobile applications and so forth. So be sure to subscribe so you'll get those just as they come out. And again, we look forward to seeing you on the next show. Thanks for listening. Take care. Bye-bye, everybody.